Returning to the refrain from the Satipatthana Sutta, I thought I'd start by just reading it again. Reading Bhikkhu Anālayo's translation. It's often useful when looking at the suttas to check different translations out, because the framing, the phrasing of different words used that the translators choose to use can give us different understandings of the meanings. So I often like to look at a variety of translations and see what nuances the different translations can kind of pull out. So here's how Anālayo translates the refrain. Except I am changing it to gender neutral. I'm not explicitly reading Anālayo's translation. I'm shifting the gender. In regard to the body, one abides contemplating the body internally, or abides contemplating the body externally, or abides contemplating the body both internally and externally. One abides contemplating the nature of arising in the body, or abides contemplating the nature of passing away in the body, or abides contemplating the nature of both arising and passing away in the body. Mindfulness that there is a body is established in one to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This is how, in regard to the body, one abides contemplating the body. And a reminder that this section of the Satipatthana Sutta, which is repeated with every exercise, every encouragement to be mindful of specific areas of experience, it's understood in many ways to be of maybe how we attend to experience so that freedom from clinging follows. This is the area or the aspect that is emphasizing the cultivation of wisdom that frees the mind. So this refrain that I read in respect to the body, but it also applies to feelings. One abides observing in feelings the nature of arising, the nature of vanishing, the nature of arising and vanishing. One abides observing in mind states its nature of arising, its nature of vanishing, its nature of arising and vanishing. One abides observing in the Dhammas, in that fourth foundation, sometimes translated as mind objects, but the word Dhamma, when it's used in the way that it seems to be in one aspect in the Satipatthana Sutta, can simply mean phenomena. And the fourth foundation encourages us to observe all phenomena, observing the Dhamma as Dhamma. And one teacher, Taraniya, came up with this very beautiful way of understanding that phrase. One understands the Dhamma as Dhamma, where the first D, the first Dhamma, is the lowercase d of just phenomena. And the second D, the second Dhamma, is uppercase D, the Buddha's way of understanding the truth, the nature of reality. And so in that fourth foundation, understanding phenomena as Dharma. as truth, and understands phenomena in its nature of arising, in its nature of vanishing, or in its nature of arising and vanishing. And so emphasizing this aspect of the refrain this afternoon, the impermanence aspect. This is such a central understanding that the Buddha pointed to free the mind from the craving, the clinging that creates stress and suffering. Over and over again. You can't go very far in the suttas without stumbling on some phrasing of noticing the arising and passing away of experience. It's, in many ways, the Four Noble Truths I understand really as a often the Four Noble Truths are phrased something like, there is suffering, there is the origin of suffering, or the cause of suffering, which is craving, there's the ending of suffering, which is the ending of craving, and there is the way leading to the ending of suffering. But the framing or the phrasing, the word actually that's used for that second noble truth is more frequently translated as arising rather than cause or origin. And so that second noble truth can be looked at as being seeing the arising of suffering. And another way to frame the including of craving in there is with the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. And that's actually my experience. It's not like craving happens and then suffering happens later. When we are aware of the experience of suffering, it's co-arising. And so right in the Four Noble Truths, there's an encouragement to notice the arising of suffering and the ending of suffering. So the impermanent nature of suffering. And so right there in the Four Noble Truths, it's bringing two of these key understandings and insights together. The understanding of impermanence and the understanding of dukkha, of suffering. I thought I'd just take a little tour of a few places in the suttas where this is emphasized, the observing the impermanent nature. Just not too long, just a little brief tour. In one place, it points to a definition of ignorance being that we don't understand form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, as subject to arising and vanishing. And so the very definition of ignorance in some places in the suttas is not understanding the impermanent nature of experience. That is the ignorance that sets off the entire chain of dependent origination. And so when we take things to be permanent, when that ignorance is there, that's when pleasant experience tends to lead to craving, unpleasant experience tends to lead to craving, that whole cycle. The mental formations arise in dependence on that belief that, or that not understanding that things are impermanent. Mental formations arise in dependence on that believing. It's useful to cling to something. Another place says that ignorance is abandoned when one directly discerns impermanence. And that the power of wisdom discerns the arising and passing away of experience and leads to the ending of suffering. So those are some pretty strong encouragements to have an inspiration to get to know the impermanent nature of experience. I am going through some of my old notes. I also found a beautiful passage that brought in something we were talking about yesterday, the joy of practice. And in one place it says that knowing impermanence, change, fading away, and cessation of experience, wholesome joy arises. So this is, sometimes we can see, sometimes we can see that as we're observing experience, even something that's a challenge. I know many of you have reported this kind of experience of even seeing something like, and somebody even described this just the other day, like seeing like anger arising and just being so delighted to see it, seeing that it is an arising and seeing that it can pass away, understanding that joy arises. The same sutta also points to different emotional relationships to the seeing of impermanence, that sometimes what happens when we see the impermanent nature of experience, the kind of longing for liberation arises, the wish for freedom arises. Or sometimes in the seeing of that impermanent nature of experience, equanimity arises. So it's not always just one flavor of the relationship. But it can be joy. It can be that real pull, that urge for freedom. Or it might simply be, yep, this is the way it is. In talking to his son at some point, I didn't search out the reference for this one today. I think it was maybe when his son was a teenager, so not the same one where he was telling his son to observe his actions before, during, after, when he was 7 years old. This was a little later in his son's life. But he encouraged his son to cultivate the perception of impermanence. Because in cultivating the perception of impermanence, the conceit I am will be abandoned. And so a connection here, again, of the different key understandings that free the mind. Impermanent, unreliable, not self, these three key insights that free the mind from clinging, that the Buddha is pointing to, that the cultivation of impermanence helps the mind to understand not self, releases the mind from that conceit. And then this phrase from this sutta is one of my favorites in that it's very evocative for me at times. It's one of those where the sentence will arise in my practice and just like help the mind to just recognize and let go. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya teaching on right view. One with right view And in this case, that phrasing, one with right view, means somebody who has the understanding, not the intellectual side of it, but the lived or discernment, the wisdom is arising. So one with this wisdom, with right view, one with right view does not take a stand about myself and has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only dukkha arising, and what ceases is only dukkha ceasing. And in that framing of dukkha, my understanding is that the use of the word there is as unreliable experience, not necessarily painful experience, because sometimes pleasant experience arises. Many times pleasant experience arises, not felt as painful, but it is not reliable as a place to land for lasting happiness. And so, rewording this perhaps, one with right view does not take a stand about myself and has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only unreliable experience arising, and what ceases is only unreliable experience ceasing. That part of the sentence, that really can help my mind to let go. Like this, what's arising here is just, it's a fleeting phenomena. It's nothing worth clinging to. And in that single sentence, again, it feels like there's an interweaving of these three powerful understandings, powerful insights. One does not take a stand about myself. Not taking a stand about self is that understanding of the liberating understanding of not self. And no perplexity or doubt that what arises, and so, and what ceases, again, the arising and ceasing pointed to, the impermanent nature of experience pointed to, is only unreliable experience arising and ceasing. Impermanence, unreliability, not self, all pulled together in this one succinct sentence. And with that, no perplexity or doubt, the mind simply doesn't have any interest in clinging. It understands it doesn't make any sense because it's just unreliable phenomenon. That's it. That's all that's happening. Moment after moment, that's all that happens. I mean, as I'm saying that, I'm delighted to think about that. But, you know, sometimes I can imagine, when times, certain times my mind kind of goes, that's all that's happening. What's the point? You know, it's, but that's the perspective of there needing to be something reliable. As the mind aligns with this truth, it's just delighted that it doesn't have to cling and it doesn't have to suffer. As the mindfulness does gain some momentum, there's a little bit of continuity. And I want to remind you that I did say the other day, and I think it bears repeating, that, you know, continuity can arise in a little burst, kind of in a moment. That the conditions that we're cultivating for mindfulness here, we are encouraging more moments of mindfulness. But continuity of mindfulness doesn't necessarily mean, I mean, the continuity of mindfulness that's capable of seeing of discerning these truths. It's not like it necessarily has to last for hours. It can arise in a moment and be there for 2 seconds and see so deeply. So some of you have talked about seeing how much there's a coming and going of mindfulness. And that's, of course, that happens. If you're not judging that for the goings, but interested in, you know, oh, it's back, this is arising. Sometimes we end up arising into, the mindfulness ends up arising into a little burst where there can be a deep understanding of seeing impermanent nature of experience, unreliable nature of experience, not self nature of experience. So as continuity happens, maybe from time to time for a few seconds here and there, maybe I could phrase it that way instead of saying as the momentum is established, because that has the language of that has made me think in the past that it had to go on for hours or days before insight would happen. And in my own experience, I finally realized, you know, as I'm not judging that, the mindfulness coming and going, that the arising of mindfulness can be very powerful. In a few moments, it can be very powerful. So as there is some more moments of continuity, bursts of continuity, at times the mind does start to attune to or be curious about the nature of experience rather than the kind of details of experience. And so this is another place where sometimes in our practice we have the habit of kind of thinking that what being mindful means is I'm seeing a lot of detail about the objects of experience. And as the mind shifts to being more curious about the general nature of experience as opposed to the specific nature of experience, the mind might not be as interested in the fine details of sensation or a sound or a taste. It may be just more interested in, wow, that just appeared. That just disappeared. And so that the quality of what the mind is looking at, that what wisdom is oriented to, may have a different flavor with the continuity, with mindfulness and wisdom kind of becoming more kind of joined up in that continuity. Wisdom starts to be more interested in impermanent nature of experience, unreliable nature of experience, conditioned nature of experience. And we can kind of begin to incline the mind in this direction. Again, because we have habits of what we think we're supposed to be paying attention to, and habits of not just through the meditation, but just through our living, the way that we kind of learned how to pay attention to the world is not through seeing that things are coming and going so much, but what those things are. And so we have a really strong habit of orienting to the details of experience, and it can be useful to remind ourselves of the value of attuning to the impermanent nature of experience. And so this can be kind of a little bit of a leaning, of an orientation, and this can be a simple thing. Sometimes it might be, in this style of practice, we can use questions at times. And it might be as simple as when there's a sense of being present and the mind at ease. How is impermanence revealing itself right now? Or impermanence, you know, kind of asking wisdom to show that quality of the experience, as opposed to being attuned more to the specifics of the experience. And we can at times kind of orient through almost a reflection to kind of being curious about, well, how am I noticing, you know, impermanence right now? Am I noticing that things are arising? Am I noticing that things are passing away? There's different levels of how we can recognize impermanence. It could be recognized at the more ordinary level, you know, just noticing, not just, because this can be a very profound reflection, noticing the changing nature of our lives. And the Buddha encouraged us to daily recollect the nature of our humanness as being subject to aging, illness, and death. This is an ordinary level of understanding impermanence, but we don't think about it very much. We kind of assume, you know, we see other people dying, we see other people getting sick, but we don't necessarily remember regularly that, yes, this body too will die. This body will age. This body will get sick. And so that encouragement to reflect at a kind of an ordinary level about the impermanent nature of experience. And also an encouragement to reflect around the objects of our world. The same set of reflections, we're encouraged to reflect. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. So possessions, ownership, impermanent. And so we can kind of be curious about, at an ordinary level, and I've done this a lot on retreat in the more ordinary daily lifetimes, and I mentioned that this morning, like chopping the zucchini and noticing the change that's happening there, and that, you know, at what point does it stop becoming a zucchini? You know, it's a real process of dissolution there. So simple things like that can turn the mind towards the impermanent nature of all experience. It can be kind of fun at times, too, to play with this, with the objects in your home, in your house, like, you know, that lamp, you know? It's there. It's pretty. It's there every day. You know, it's not like it seems to be popping in and out. It's there. So it's got a stability to it, and that kind of stability, you know, we forget when things have that kind of stability that they are impermanent. You know, there's the vast cosmic levels of impermanence, like, you know, at some point every single thing on this planet will be burned up as the sun kind of, you know, expands in its death throes. So that lamp isn't going to survive that. You know, we can kind of reflect on that. You know, that lamp is not permanent in that way. And another fun thing to explore there is to just kind of reflect on everything in your surroundings, you know. It came into being at some point. And we can use a reflection here. It's kind of fun to think about, well, how did that lamp come into being, you know? Somebody actually had to mine the ore to get the metal. And then it was refined and heated up, and then it was molded. And, like, how many people did this go through? And so this reflection on this lamp coming into being encourages also a reflection on the process by which it came into being. It didn't just pop into being. There's a whole process of many steps that had this come into being. And then, and for my sake, you know, it came into being for me pretty much when I purchased it. And I don't usually think about that whole set of stuff that had to go on for it to actually arise. In a conversation about this, the other day, a couple weeks ago, I was having this conversation about impermanence with a group in the morning, one of my morning groups. And this person says, you know, it does seem like certain things like that watering can are just amazingly stable. You know, it gets a little dinged here and there, but it's always there. It's, you know, it doesn't seem very impermanent. So I took him through this kind of reflection. But then I pointed to, you know, actually the suffering around objects in a way is not so much about the fact that objects are impermanent. They are. But that we attribute a permanence to the ownership of those objects. You know, that it's mine. You know, that lamp is mine. I'm not terribly attached to the lamp, but, you know, if something happened, somebody came in and ransacked my house and took the lamp, you know, that would be kind of startling. It's not here anymore. You know, it exists somewhere, probably, unless the person who took it decided to melt it down. But, you know, the suffering around objects is often not so much to do with the objects themselves being impermanent, but with our relationship, that relationship of ownership being impermanent. And we don't like that so much. When something's mine, we want to have say over whether it isn't mine anymore. We want to be able to say, okay, now I'm done with that lamp, so I'm going to offer it to Goodwill. And somebody else can enjoy it for a while, and I can feel magnanimous about, you know, letting go of the ownership of it. But I have control over that kind of movement. And so the idea, you know, is that I get to pick when something is mine or not. And that, you know, so it's a kind of an attribution of permanence of ownership, in a way, we could say, kind of interweaving again these insights around, or these misunderstandings in this case, around me, mine, who I am, and the impermanent nature of that process. Another useful reflection, again, this is, so the reflective process, you know, we sometimes dismiss in our preferencing for being mindful in a very non-discursive way, we don't appreciate so much the value of reflection. And the Buddha actually encouraged us to use reflection quite a bit. You know, these five subjects for frequent recollection, he's encouraging us to bring into our mind, bringing thoughts into our mind about the impermanent nature of our experience. This is a way of bringing wisdom. It's like bringing wisdom reflections into the mind that begins to orient the mind towards a deeper understanding of those truths, of those wisdoms. And so another kind of reflection that the Buddha offered around you know, the ownership of things, or the kind of way in which we attribute happiness to having some kind of hold on something. And again, this is bringing into play the understandings around how we cling to things thinking they're reliable. And we think they're reliable because we think they're permanent. So the Buddha said that, yes, there will be some kind of happiness around the having of things and the having of experiences. It's not just about material things. But there will be some kind of happiness that comes from when we get something that we want, or when we get rid of something that we don't want. And a reflection he encouraged us to make about that happiness is to be curious about how long does that happiness last? Essentially, how permanent is that happiness? And how reliable is that happiness? Because the way in which we tend to go around searching for happiness, we don't often really recognize how unreliable that strategy is. So the Buddha directly encourages us to be curious. Yeah, so you've gotten some happiness from getting that thing, or, you know, okay, how long does it last? We don't often think about that, because as soon as that happiness kind of goes, we're immediately launching into looking for some more of that kind of happiness. So we see the impermanent nature of that happiness, which is often based on the impermanent nature of what we had relied on for that happiness. As we move more into the away from the reflective and into the experiential understanding of impermanence, seeing impermanence at a more subtle level, directly through the mindfulness, through the mindfulness and wisdom and the continuity that can happen in moments, we start to see that it's not just about objects, you know, that really this is pointing back to the experience level of the moment-to-moment experience level. That nothing lasts for very long. There's a very rapidly changing body sensations, thoughts, feelings, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches. Nothing is stable for very long. In fact, it's not stable at all. It's as soon as it begins to come into being, it's already falling apart. The very rapidity of change can kind of mask the impermanence. Just the way our perceptual system works. If something is flashing in and out very quickly, you know, something on, off, on, off, on, off, on, off, we probably don't necessarily see that flickering. You know, the old movie theaters had the films where they had these individual frames, and there's a little gap, and then an individual frame. So still pictures, individual still pictures run by the projector really quickly, so rapidly moving pictures, and we don't see the gaps. We don't experience it as still picture off, still picture off, still picture off. We see it as some kind of continuity. Our minds, our perceptual system tends to create that stability with the rapid changing nature of experience. And so some of the confusion about impermanence and that we think things are stable is partly because it's helpful for our perceptual system to stabilize the world so we can navigate it. You know, even as I move my head in the room, it's like mostly I feel like I'm moving my head and the objects in the room are staying put. But that's not what's coming into the visual system. You know, the visual system is actually seeing this very jumpy kind of thing, and our mind stabilizes it. So that's a part of why it's so hard at this deep level to see impermanence. And then there's another piece that comes into play that's pretty profound. And that is, you know, the tendency for the mind to cling to those perceptions, you know, so just describing that, you know, the mind is stabilizing experience. so that I can navigate the world and not, like, you know, feel like I'm walking on a ship that's, like, on stormy seas. But what our minds do with that stabilized experience is that we believe that that experience is stable, permanent, and worth clinging to. We cling to ideas, concepts, and that, you know, that clinging to concept kind of masks, again, masks the changing nature of the experience. So objects often seem stable because we're not experiencing them directly. We're experiencing them through the concept of the object. We take the concept to be the thing. Now, this maybe can be revealed in some simple ways. You know, things change often. You know, objects often change kind of slowly, you know, unless something dramatic happens to them. But, you know, you might, like, notice one day that you know, there's this big, like, worn spot on the lamp where, you know, you've turned the handle over and over again or something. You know, that there's this wearing down there. And it's like, it's happened very gradually. It has been changing. But it just, at some point, the mind kind of clicks and recognizes, oh, it has changed. And part of that is because we tend to see things as they have been in the past. We tend to see things through the concept. And that happens at very subtle levels. And so this kind of, I'm talking about this because, again, it helps the mind sometimes to understand how clinging works. Because when we cling to something, when clinging is arising in the mind, it's always clinging to some idea or concept. There's no way that we can cling to direct experience because it is so rapidly changing. But the mind can stabilize a concept for long enough to think it's got something worthy or something stable enough to cling to. And so that is what we cling to. We don't actually cling to the lamp. We cling to the idea of the lamp and that the lamp is mine. So this is an interesting exploration. You know, that I suggested in the guided meditation this morning that, you know, sometimes we can directly see or kind of attune to the impermanent nature of experience, noticing that there's a rising and passing or just a flow of change or kind of a, you know, discrete kind of experience of something arises and then something else arises or something ends and there's just this, like, slipping away. Sometimes it feels like just, like, slippery vanishings. But sometimes what it feels like is that there's no, that something's stable there. And when that's what's happening, it's not necessarily so useful to try to say, well, how can I see the impermanence there? It's more useful to say, well, what is this that the mind thinks is stable? And a great question or curiosity is, you know, what is the mind actually clinging to in that moment? And when it thinks something is stable, there's some kind of view or belief there. And so what is it? What is it that the mind is clinging to? When it feels like something is stable, what is it that is actually stable? What is it that seems stable? And the kind of the amazing thing of this whole thing is, like, you know, we're clinging to some, like, construction in the mind. And constructions in the mind are, like, you know, some of the most ephemeral things out there. And yet our mind has this capacity to kind of hold a concept stable for a little while and then cling to it. Another piece around the phrasing of the refrain that kind of speaks to me one observes the nature of arising and the nature of passing away in Anaglio's version. Observing the nature of arising, the nature of passing away. Some of that can be understood as pointing to the nature of the experience as impermanent. That just that simple understanding of experience as coming and going can be very freeing. But that kind of the nature of arising itself points back to conditionality. Because things don't arise randomly. They arise in dependence on conditions. So the nature of arising is that there are conditions that support the arising of certain experience. And conditions that, when they are absent, mean that those experiences won't arise. When this is, that is. When this arises, that arises. When this ceases. When this isn't, that isn't. When this ceases, that ceases. All arisings, all ceasings, arise and cease in dependence on conditions. And this is how the practice manages to work. We see the conditioned nature of our minds habitually having the arisings of reactivity, the habits around greed, aversion, and delusion. So they're tending to arise because they've been conditioned to arise. But they don't have to keep arising if the conditions change. One of the strongest conditions that supports the shift, mindfulness and wisdom. Sometimes seeing this conditionality in the arisings. And we understand, for example, we might see feeling tone arising in dependence on some view. And craving arises in dependence on the feeling tone. We might see at times that if a view is weaker or there's a different view in the mind, that a different unfolding happens. We might even see with a different view that the feeling tone around a very similar experience is completely different. Views what our beliefs are, what we think about things, very strongly condition the arising of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. An example, the commentaries offer the example around seeing a snake in the corner of a room, or seeing a snake, and that how when you see that snake, there's going to be most likely unpleasant experience, unless it's like a pet snake that you know, but we're not thinking about that right now. It's a snake you kind of come in upon suddenly. And, we can get startled by that, and there can be unpleasant experience. The fear, is this a poisonous snake? Am I safe? So there's that kind of depending on the snake, we think, depending on the snake, is the unpleasant experience. But it's not the snake that unpleasant experience is dependent on. The unpleasant experience is dependent on our belief that it's a snake. Now, that may be hard to see, but it's not the snake actually that we're responding to. It's the belief that it's a snake. So that's where the feeling arises. Believing it's a snake, unpleasant feeling, along with knowing and having many associations about what snakes mean. Whole, huge, like complex of stuff coming together to create that feeling tone. And we think it's just a snake making me feel like, unpleasant. It's a whole set of conditions that lead to that arising of that unpleasant feeling. And then the commentaries point to, this is the classic kind of the mistaken perception that it was a snake when we notice that it's not a snake, but it's actually a coiled rope in the corner. When our perception of it as a snake is corrected, we can see the way that feeling of unpleasant was conditioned on the belief and not on the fact that there was a snake there, because there isn't a snake there in this case. So the views, the beliefs, what the beliefs and views are arising very strongly condition the feelings that arise. And so, understanding this kind of conditioned nature of arisings, and sometimes seeing that can also be very freeing. And as we begin to understand how that clinging happens, in dependence on that, attributing some kind of reality to those beliefs, attributing some kind of permanence and truth in a way to what is taken, the constructs of our mind, taken as reality. I'll kind of end with the reminder of simplicity in practice. At times we can kind of orient lightly towards curiosity about impermanence. But largely, our work is cultivating that simplicity, the simple mind that can see the complexity of experience. Not looking for things, not trying to see impermanence so that I get some insight, just simple. You know, so much of the understandings that happen now, we think they have to be these big mind-blowing insights in order for them to count. But so much of the practice the Buddha pointed to as being a very gradual unfolding. We may not be seeing how our mind is beginning to learn about this nature, at least consciously. That gradual weakening of craving and clinging, wearing away of that. Maybe at some point there is a kind of a experience of release. But sometimes that understanding can reveal itself after the fact. You know, that letting go has happened, and we didn't see that letting go happen. We just now recognize, wow, that particular kind of suffering hasn't come up in a while, and I didn't see it go away. So much of practice unfolds in that way, and so it does take trust. You've all been practicing for quite a long time, and so the Dalai Lama famously said, you know, look back 5 years, 10 years, and notice the difference. That's how we can kind of see the effect that practice has on us. We want the sudden kind of realization. We want something to prove to us in a split second that this practice is worth it. And sometimes we get those, you know. Sometimes those happen. But so much of the value of practice unfolds on this just gradual wearing away. Of the kilesa. Of the defilements. Let's just sit together for a few moments.